Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00046. Recorded on May 18, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Pawns in the game. Pawns in the game. Chapter 46.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
There are various stops along the way as I rock and roll through the hamster wheel of my life. 8:48, just about every single workday morning, I arrive and park the F-150 mobile studio in the lot at my place of work. Like so routinely, you know? My life, my commute. Yes, my commute and my life. Perhaps my commute, therefore my life, is run up and down Texas State Highway 78, right? Texas State Highway 78. It's a highway that runs from the city of Dallas up to the city of Denison, Texas, on the Red River, right? It runs northeast in a northeasterly direction out of Dallas. And once you get past my workplace, you have pretty much evolved out of the suburbs, right? Dallas, the city, and then what's it, Garland, the city. And then what, you start getting into the suburbs in Saxe and Wylie and La Vaughn. And then after that, it starts to become more or less open country, right? Country not too far away from where I work, but yet I'm still in the suburbs here. And then it remains pretty much country all the way out to the Red River. The Red River, of course, being the border between Texas and Oklahoma, right? So we're not really all that far from Oklahoma in greater DFW, the Metroplex as it's known. What's it, an hour and a half, depending on what part of the region you're in, up these highways. And 78 is kind of the highway of enterprise in my life and my wife also, right? We both commute up and down the same road, virtually the same distance at different times, right? She leaves for work earlier than I do. So much of what I've done otherwise, like when I was spending more time in and amongst the biker community, a lot of that would go out into the country up 78. Farmersville, Princeton, up that away, and beyond, out through Blue Ridge. There's a little biker haven up there known as Westminster, a square, an old town square that has a retail shop up there that is geared towards bikers. What the hell is it called? The Motorcycle Outpost. And there's a bar and grill on that square also, where a lot of bikers like to sit down and throw one down. It's out in that general direction. And then, but anyway, yeah, my life as a citizen of Texas, for the most part, I'd say since like 2010 anyway, has been up and down this Highway 78. And I would call that, you know, in terms of daily living, kind of the eastern parameter of my day-to-day life. The western one would probably be Highway 75. It runs kind of sort of parallel, but more south to north direction. So, you know, my existence is kind of functions between this kind of wedge, this kind of slice of pizza pie wedge that runs down from the Red River to Dallas, the city of Dallas, right? So, but yeah, my commute runs, my commute runs right up and down 78, almost wholly, you know, with a W, wholly. And I imagine, God damn, the throat. Every time I get to doing a monologue, my throat dries up on me. Apologize for that. It's almost ridiculous how many times I pull up at the end of my morning commute here, right at 8:48. You know, sometimes I leave, you know, 8:30 is kind of like my goal getaway time. Sometimes I don't pull out till 8:32. Sometimes I'm a little early. You know, it might be 8:27. But somehow, some way, I almost always roll up at this mysterious, mythical time of 8:48. I don't know. I've been commuting in the workforce for some 35 years, right? 35 years ago, you know, a few more weeks, it'll be 30 years since I got clean, or 35 years since I got clean and sober, and somewhere right around this time, maybe to the very day, I exited my military career and entered into the greater workforce of metropolitan New York City, right? Out in Jersey, because so much of my life happened in Jersey. And yeah, I got sober, cleaned myself up, and entered into humanity proper. became a responsible and productive human being. You know, my father used to always teach me to be responsible. And he would say, you've got to... He had this accent, European accent, that I can't do. All right? I got too many of my own accents to imitate him. I never could, for whatever reason, right? But he used to say that I needed to be a responsible human being. Right? Not human being, a human being. And he used to tell me that since I was like the age of 4, right? He's like, when are you going to grow up and be a responsible human being? Yeah, the little kid. Yeah, okay. But yeah, that's pretty much when that pursuit began, right? I got sober in 1988, right? 1988. And, you know, took up a couple of jobs that year, trying to get off the ground and getting a civilian life together. I started out, delivering roofing and siding off of a flatbed truck. And then I took a job for about a month or two as a painter, right? House painter, commercial residential painter, interiors, exteriors, whatever. A couple of my cousins were working for this guy, and they got me a job with them. And I did that until I got something better. And so there was really not much of a commute. Like that first job driving, it was the next town over, right? I wouldn't call it walking distance, but if I had to, I could, you know, in pursuit of drugs and shit, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll as a teenager, I'd walk that far and further. And so it wasn't much of a commute, per se. Didn't sit in traffic. It was all back roads. It took 5 minutes. Right? That's not a commute. In this job, painting, I would just ride out to the job sites. So they could be anywhere in central and north Jersey. Most of it was pretty local to where I was living, but none of it was really routine. You know, you'd go to one place for a day or two, then you'd go somewhere else for a day or two. So not really a commute, you know, not riding in your own tracks day after day. And I think that qualifies as a commute. It's part of your routine of life. Like I say, the hamster wheel, right? The hamster wheel of your life. You're just running in your own fucking tracks. Same thing, day in, day out, to the point where you can't even tell one day from the next. So I finally got a commute. The next job after that, I got a job down in the city of New Brunswick, New Jersey, right? Which is the county seat of Middlesex County. Middlesex County is kind of the gateway to the Jersey Shore, right? That's where the Raritan River runs through, and then it opens up into the Raritan Bay, and you got proximity to, Staten Island, which is one of the five boroughs in New York City right there, and then all the bay towns that run along Raritan Bay on the north side of the Jersey Shore out to the ocean, right? So you go along the way, and you got these towns, Keyport and Keensburg, Leonardo, right, where Clerks took place, right? You had the convenience store where the movie Clerks took place. A real place. I used to go there. Like, I would ride out when I did telecommuting jobs later on in life. I would take off in the middle of the day, give myself a good three-hour break, and go to the beach. And I'd go to Sandy Hook Beach, right? That's a part of Gateway National Park. And I would go right through Leonardo on Route 36 through Middlesex County, and by the time you get out there, it becomes Monmouth County, right? So I'd ride out through Middlesex County and end up at Sandy Hook. That's not Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Different Sandy Hook. This is Sandy Hook in New Jersey, right? Not a town. It's a park, a beach park. But I would stop in Leonardo and get like a couple packs of cigarettes, cold drink, a coffee, snack cake, whatever, you know. A real place. Yeah, the video store, RST Video right next to it. Real place, you know. That wasn't fabricated for the film. It's an actual place. I don't know if it's still open, but it was back in those days. Back in the 90s as it was, in the early 2000s. But Middlesex County, right? New Brunswick, New Jersey is the county seat. That's a little bit more inland. It's up the Raritan River. It's where Rutgers University is. And I had a job right downtown, right? There was a print shop downtown, like where the tall buildings are and everything. And it was very similar. It was very similar to work in, say, like in certain parts of Manhattan for a few blocks, right? It was not, New Brunswick's not a huge city, and its downtown's not a huge downtown, but it is very Manhattan-like for a little while there. And I was kind of like plunked down in the middle. Like, you had the county offices and all the lawyers and everything, the taller buildings, the hotels, you know, the fancier restaurants, the main drag right through the downtown, all that. That was my commute from, I was up in Bridgewater, New Jersey at the time, and I was commuting out to New Brunswick. Now, not very far to go. I mean, maybe 15 minutes, maybe not. 10 to 15 minutes, not really a commute. But yeah, it is sort of, kind of. But it was definitely routine. You know, it was every weekday job. I'd get in my old, I had a 1971 Chevy Nova Super Sport, right? Big old 8-cylinder 350 motor in it. Thing hauled ass. It was a fucking death trap. It was a piece of shit, you know? It's like you hit the brake, and you had to steer right because the car would steer left whenever you hit the brake. It was so like out of alignment, and the brake pads were so fucked up, and everything was just so jacked. You'd hit the brake and you'd do like a 90 degree left turn, so you'd have to compensate. When you were about to brake, you had to turn right at the same time to keep straight. Really fucked up, you know. And in the summertime, the heater, like I had heat and AC, but the heat only worked in the summer. The AC only worked in the winter, and you couldn't turn it off. It was like, oh, it was such a fucking mess, right? So you'd be hot as balls driving around in the summertime in that car. And when the winter came along, the inside of the window would freeze, right? The inside of your windshield, instead of the outside like it ought to, the inside would freeze. I'd have to sit there scraping it off as I drove. You know, so right-handed, I'm scraping. Left-handed, I'm holding the steering wheel. When I hit the brake, I got to turn it to the right. All at the same time, right? All at the same time. Fucked up. You know, it was an automatic, which on the one hand sucks, but being that the car was in the condition that the car was in, it was kind of a blessing because I needed all the hands just to accomplish all that. That car was supposed to be a project car. Me and my brother were going to work on it. I ended up buying like just a little piece of shit commuter car, my first bank loan, right? Really, a Ford Escort. What a piece of fucking crap that thing was. But it was the cheapest car you could buy. And I was dirt poor, right? I wasn't making diddly shit for money working at this little print shop in New Brunswick, as it was. So I got that, but me and my brother decided to keep the Nova. I didn't trade it in. They weren't going to give me shit for it anyway. And what we were going to do is just, you know, throw it up in a garage somewhere and work on it together, kind of like as an excuse for us to spend some time, because our lives at that point were starting to veer off in different directions, right? We're into our 20s. I got clean and sober. He's still partying it up, right? So you could see it happening. So we were coming up with ways to like kind of force ourselves to get together on some kind of routine basis, right? One of them was supposed to be this Chevy Nova. I spoke a previous episode about time we spent coaching a baseball team together, right? We tried to do that. My brother's great. I spoke with him on the phone twice in the past 2 weeks. Both of our birthdays come around the same time, and we generally will call one another for the birthdays, and we talk 2-3 times, maybe 4 in a course of a year, depending on things. He's just a great guy, and he's a great guy. My brother's really cool. But that's how it was back then. Now, the problem with the Nova was that while I was driving the piece of shit commuter car Ford Escort that I really fucking hated, well, he took out the Nova one night, and well, he had this habit of, he would try to drive an automatic transmission as if it was standard, right? So he would shift gears. He would go from the low gears, low one, low two, low three, pop it into fucking drive. And he was always blowing transmissions. He had like two or three old Camaros that were automatic that he destroyed the transmission. And he did the same thing with this Nova, right? He's driving it right through the middle of Martinsville, right? Downtown through the retail section of the village. And apparently, as the story goes, he's shifting gears and the transmission locked the fuck up. He spun out of control and drove right up into somebody's fucking house in the living room. No more Nova after that. That project never happened as a result. But, you know, so commuting in that Nova to New Brunswick, right? It was me. This is where I remember, like, really starting to listen to AM radio. I don't know what the story was. I think, you know, in that car, I wasn't really getting good reception on anything, but I was getting kind of, you know, the big AM stations out of New York City were coming in pretty good. So I would listen to that, and I'd get ideas about traffic and weather and all. And back in the 80s, the AM radio, it was a little bit different than it is now, right? A little bit different. Kind of organized and structured in the same way, at least, you know, as far as a listener, right? Your perspective as a listener. And what I mean to say is, like, you have these certain segments of whatever show it is that you're listening to, and then you have commercial breaks, advertisement, and it would come back and it would, like, throw some news at you, the weather, maybe sports, and then go back into the, you know, resume what you're programming, as they call it. And, yeah, it's similar to that now, but what was different back then? And it might not be the case across the board, but, you know, wherever I listen to any kind of AM talk radio, AM radio in general, I don't see this anymore. What I'm trying to say is it was kind of the advertising, the marketing back then on radio was jingle-oriented, right? Jingle-oriented. Jingle being kind of like a snippet of music that was strictly oriented to the purpose of marketing product or service, right? And these jingles, as they were back then, the musical style seemed to be something very old, right? This is called what it was, old, out of date, antique, beyond traditional. And you know, I look at it from as like probably music that would date back to like the 40s, right? 30s, 40s, which is not really any different than, you know, what grunge is now, today, in 2023, right? But, you know, you're talking about a 30 years, well, that would have been more like a 50-year swing. So, yeah, a little bit different. But it just seemed old, you know? And, of course, when it comes to AM radio, especially talk shows on the AM radio, the target, the audience was generally, more so then than it is now, but back then, it was the elderly, right? Seniors would listen to that, or, you know, workaday Joes in the office, perhaps. So the appeal to those from the older generations would be musical stylings that they were familiar and comfortable with, right? So me, I'm a kid. I'm just entering into the workforce. And that's not like the first job or jobs that I ever had at that point in time. I started working when I was like 14. And I held jobs on and off throughout my teenage years. But as far as like being in the workforce and in the commuting populace, a workaday Joe, as I call it, you know, it began around that time. So anyway, it was this jingle-oriented stuff. And when I would listen to it as a 21-year-old, I recognized it as, you know, old fogey music. I'm listening to old fogey radio. And, like, I'm becoming an old fogey. I don't even know what the fuck a fogey is. What's a fogey? It's one of those words that you parrot, right? You hear everybody use it, and you get an idea what it means, but never actually broke out the dictionary. I don't know how to even spell fogey. It's not coming up that way. Let's try it this way. Fogey. Okay, there it is. There's a fogey. A variant of another way of spelling it. We'll try that one. Okay, a person of stodgy or old-fashioned habits and attitudes, right? Which I've now become, you know, at the ripe old age of 56, I have become more or less like that. But at 21, I was not so much, but I had the sense that I was kind of wading in that fucking pool very much prematurely, you know? It's just a weird sense, you know. So it's just, I would listen to that New York City AM radio, and it gave me what I could describe as a New York City feel. And I already described to you how downtown New Brunswick was very Manhattan-like, right? I'll take that a step further, you know, very traditional old city type with tall buildings, right, that had retail and restaurant type of establishments on the ground floor, and then actually rental apartments on top of it for 10, 15, 20 stories up, right? That is a city, and it's very Manhattan-like. So I had this sense, because I was listening to local AM news and talk, news talk radio as I commuted. And then when I got to the end of my commute, I parked in a city parking lot somewhere and then walked through the city to get to my place of employment. And I would stop along the way. And along the way, there was like a, you know, some guy was running a Jew deli around the corner. And I'd go in and I'd get a bagel and a coffee. Again, on a very routine basis, right? We get into the hamster wheel of life no matter how we're living it. And it was every day. I'd park in this parking lot. I'd walk in this direction. I'd stop in this guy's deli. I'd get a bagel with butter and a coffee, you know, regular as it was back then. It would dip the cream and sugar, right? I don't drink it like that now. Now it's black. But back then, you know, while still acquiring a taste after 4 years of drinking coffee, I drank it the way it was introduced to me when I was on a construction crew, you know. We would go out and the older guys would just buy like a dozen regular coffees and just give it out to whoever wanted them, right? And so I would, you know, if it was cold in the winter, I would get my cup of coffee and I would just drink it the way they got. And that's what I thought coffee was meant to be. I do not think that now. I don't think milk has a place in coffee. I don't add undue sucrose into my existence either, right? I'll drink it just straight black or with saccharin sweetener, right? Because I need something carcinogenic because I don't want to live forever. It's something to kill me, right? Anyway, so I would get my bagel and coffee every day routinely, you know, eat it as I walked, get into my place of work and get into the routine. You know, I don't remember much about that routine. I really didn't work there all that long, a couple of months. It was a job I got through my wife number one, when we were dating, her father, who would eventually become my father-in-law, right? He had a buddy from the old days who ran the print shop. That was his business, right? That was his retail operation. So they worked it out to hire me on to take that job and get away from that painting situation. I was having difficulties with the painting situation because, you know, my cousins were there. My cousins were party. I used to party with them, you know. And I was kind of around that element when I was very early in my recovery. And it was just, it was a suck situation for me. So the family helped get me out of it and get me into something else, you know, keep me working. And so what I did, you know, I was pretty much a gopher. I did a little bit of everything in the place. The print shop, you know, city print shop. I did pre-press work, like setting up for the presses and everything like that, and the ink. And I did bindery work. They were teaching me the presses. That was the plan anyway, teach me how to be a pressman. But it just seemed there was never time to really include me in. We had two guys that ran the presses. One was like the manager of the operation, and he ran a press all day and dealt with whatever squabbles were going on with the staff. And then the other guy was just his buddy, you know, and he just ran the press. We had two presses that were going, AB Dick presses, and you know, it required mechanical aptitude, which at that time of my life, I had like none, right? None. More so now, but with the limited exposure I was getting to it, I wasn't ever going to become a pressman, you know, because they would just, you know, as soon as they would start showing me something, I'd get run off. I was, like I said, I was in the, I would get the pre-press, and when I'd start learning about running the machines, I'd get run off to do bindery work or run deliveries through the city. You know, they use me as a delivery boy. It's a real piece of shit fucking car. Not as bad as my Escort, but what the hell was it? Plymouth Horizon? A little square club foot of a piece of shit car that you just zipped. They're good for the city. It was real short front to back, but, you know, four-cylinder automatic, had no get-up and go. I hated that fucking car. But, you know what I remember about this place that I hated so much? This is 1988, and they played a pop music radio station all day long, right? And now, if you ever listen to pop radio stations, they just play like the same 5-10 songs over and over again. It's like what's on top of the chart, and they just recycle it all the way through. I don't know. Maybe they've changed some shit over the years. Music industry is a lot different. I'm way out of touch with any of that. I was never a pop music aficionado. I mean, I maybe so to a degree in the 70s as I was being brought up, you know, where I was adopting adult music. You know, adults would play the pop stuff of the 70s, so I got a familiarity with that. But when the 80s came along, I was gone. I was listening to rock and punk and metal, and I was gone. I had no desire whatsoever to listen to pop at all. Pop, they were trying to, you know, push through to you through MTV, and MTV was fucking horrible in the digital 80s, and it got worse. It never got better. It just always sucked. You know, it could have been such a basic, wonderful thing. Whatever, I don't want to talk about that. Fuck that. It pisses me off, you know? That should have been a good thing, and it wasn't, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, pop music, 1988, the certain, we'll call it another, hamster wheel of fucking music that would play, which would be the backdrop of my hamster wheel in New Brunswick. That summer and then the fall and however, you know, into the fall I worked there, and then I got a better job, you know, my first real job in an office, following that, working for a bank. But there was a certain roster of songs that would play on this pop station, and the one that I remember that I fucking hated, that I hated it so much then that I still hate it to this day, because every hour on the hour they played this song. There's some, I don't know who they are, they're called UB40, and the song was called Red Red Wine. I think it was a Neil Diamond song, who I also dislike very much, right? So somebody took something that I already disliked to begin with, did a remake of it, and then they remade it with a reggae style, which, go figure, I also dislike that. I've never been a reggae fan at all. Now, you may be. Most of the people I ever knew that actually liked reggae were deadheads. And why would a deadhead like reggae? Because it's all about the marijuana. That's the link between the two. It doesn't matter how shitty the music is. If it has something to do with smoke and bone, they all in, right? I never. I think one of the worst songs Led Zeppelin ever did was their attempt at reggae with Jermaker, right? Jermaker. Some people call it Dire Maker or Dire Mocker. Jermaker. It's some kind of like Welsh spelling and pronunciation of the island of Jamaica. You know, people should stick to what they're good at. Just put it that way. Hey, me included. I'm always trying shit, right? I get it. I understand reaching out in different directions. But yeah, reggae I did not like. UB40, I don't know if they were technically a reggae band like Jamaicans. I don't know. But the music was that. And the song. I don't know what these guys look like or where they were from, what their biographies were. It's a one-hit wonder, right? In the 80s, late 80s, one-hit wonder. I was listening to a completely different kind of music. If I wasn't listening to my AM, you know, New York City AM news talk on my commute, I was listening to Metallica and Motorhead. I heard a lot of Guns N' Roses. They were fairly new at that time. I think they had just come out that time, 88. With their first album. My wife really liked it, so and it was on the radio, a couple of their songs, their most popular songs right from the beginning. always on the radio. When I wasn't at work, you know, when I wasn't at work, I wasn't on the radio at work. It was always this fucking UB40 Red Red Wine constantly, you know. Now, they played probably like 6, 7, 8 other songs within the hour, mixed up, you know, with their programming and the advertisements and all that shit, as radio stations were. It just seemed whenever I passed through the press section of the print shop operation, that was the song that these two pressmen had going on, right? And these guys were like fucking twins, right? They're like early 30s. They were kind of goofy, sort of nerdish. They were both tubby, right? Fat and pasty. And, you know, you could tell that they were old-time burnouts. And what they both got married and had a couple of kids. This was their job, and that would be their career forever and ever. They were all settled into it. All they did was stand at the press all day, listen to this shitty pop music, which I think they ran because it was just generic. But they actually liked the songs, you know. They would sing along with them and everything like that. But they would eat breakfast and lunch and dinner, and then they would go home and have dinner. You know, they were just, that was it. They were into their lives, and that was their thing. That was their realm, and I was just passing through. And every time I passed through, Red, Red Wine. Oh, my God, I fucking hate that song. You know, I'd get to the end of my day eventually, and I'd have the commute home or the commute over to my in-laws, you know. Before, you know, while I was still dating my first wife, I would just stop over because that was on the way. That was the next town over. I didn't have to go all the way back up the mountain and shit. And I'd just go be with her. And, you know, that was my solace. We'd go off to AA meetings and shit like that. But that little strip of driving, whether I went all the way back into Bridgewater or whether I stopped off in the town was Somerset, right? I would eventually live in Somerset myself. And worked there multiple times in multiple places. Somerset, New Jersey became a the core of my existence, you know, for a little bit there. You know, most of my life was up and down Route 22, as I've mentioned before, right? Like Route 78, Highway 78 here in Texas has become my Route 22 in New Jersey. But my time in New Brunswick was a little deviation away from 22, you know. I lived and worked in New Brunswick, and my highway of enterprise became Route 27, you know, from like North Brunswick up to New Brunswick, and then peeling off of that into Somerset proper. Anyway, whatever that's worth. But as I would take that ride at the end of the workday out of New Brunswick, wherever I was going to end up, I would still have that same New York City AM radio station. It was 770, right? ABC. And it was news talk, which means news and then talking politics. And its orientation in those days was almost exclusively conservative talk. There may have been a couple of odd exceptions late at night, early in the morning. I don't recall exactly. In 1988, 1989, who was I listening to on the drive time commute at the end of the day? Maybe it was that old curmudgeon Bob Grant? Probably, right? Probably. So I'm listening to that until I get where I'm going. Right. And these are the days of my life when I was really getting that introduction to news talk radio, which is really just code word for politics. You've got it for left and right alike, you know, different stations. And some stations will dare to mix a little of it together, but that was then. The polarity of society as it is now, you don't really see that. I don't know if you see it anywhere anymore. You're one or the other, no mixture of both. And I think that's kind of sad because that means the conversation's over. The chasm widens and deepens between the two. The polarity is greater. Sad state of affairs, really. We culturally suck. But what happens is when you get into the polarity of it all, when you start to get an idea who you are, relative towards your political persuasion, you start to camp out there in so many ways. And your thinking, your conversations, obviously what you listen to on the radio, the more you invest in that internally and externally, right, in your communications, obviously the more you're engaged in it. And the more you're engaged in it, I think the more removed you are from your actual reality. Let me explain that. We all have got our own little gardens to tend to. You know, what's real in our lives is what we get our hands on and what we set our eyes on and what we hear from actual people in our presence, right? That's the reality around us. We have our own terms of life that we have to deal with day to day. The shit that happens. Injuries and illness and the news of the family. Difficulties, problems, bills, you know. Domestic things, you know, I don't want to say problems or issues. What I mean to say is yard work, chores, cleaning, paying the bills, you know, all this shit, right? Whatever. You get what I'm saying. I'm not really saying anything nobody don't know about. But what I'm trying to express here is we have our own actuality in reality, and then we've got our dalliances outside of our own scope. And I think what happens is as we engage more and more in especially talk radio, whatever the conversation may be, but when we find ourselves entrenched in it, engaging it, like taking up a campsite, pitching a fucking tent in the ideologies being discussed, we have this way of gradually removing ourselves from our actual reality and living in this false reality. It becomes a diversion. And in that, right, in that is the idea of escaping a present situation, present circumstance that you're just basically not happy about. We're trading in our actuality for an imaginary life, you know. When it comes to politics, we start becoming fanboys of talking heads and politicians, which is a brutal mistake that anybody stands to make. Be a fanboy of anything and anybody is mistaken. We've always got to, like, make effort to be spiritually centered and based in reality, you know, 2 feet squarely planted in our own personal realities, not in these philosophical debates about governance and economics and culture. That's pie in the sky shit. That's great chessboard manipulation. And you know what? I'm a workaday Joe, and so are you. We are not power people, people of privilege, of high society, that has the luxury of living in ivory towers and looking down at the world and trying to make plans and designs for the populace of peasants. I realized, you know, as time went by, out of the 80s and into the 90s, I would go through these phases where I found myself more wrapped up in the discussion of the politics of the day, right, that were happening. And I would get my information from talk radio shows as I was commuting and things like that. And then I'd find similar like-minded people at work and away from work, and then my discussions with them would be on those lines too, right? And you enhance each other with informations and philosophies and beliefs. And you ever hear of this guy? No, I never heard of him. Oh, you ought to check him out, right? You start to expand your horizons of political icons, right? And that's a key word. That's a key factor. And icons are a reality. We establish icons and we kind of begin to set up a reverence, a pattern of habitual reverence to them. And in doing so, not only are we getting further away from our own actuality, but our spirituality starts to go off kilter. We start to remove ourselves from God, and we start to have reverence for things, not of the church, but of the world instead, right? So our spirituality gets off kilter. So it became obvious to me as the years were going by through my 20s that when I fell into these little valleys of patterns of spending a lot of time listening to, contemplating, and speaking about politics, things related to politics, I was in a diversionary cycle, and I was actually at odds with my own reality. It became a red flag in which I recognize that there's something fundamentally wrong with me, and I need to stop that shit and get recentered and refocused into what's real. Now, I can't give you like a recurring timeline factor of how frequently I'd fall back into that valley. I would say a couple of times a year I'd come in and out of it, you know? And I mean, to this day, I still engage in that, but it's become a lot different, you know? As the years have gone by, I'm not reliant on AM radio for any kind of information like that. Not reliant on a television. You know, I didn't even mention that, but television's a big part of it. It started back in those days. You started to have like 24/7 cable news going on. And the cable news networks would orient themselves around politics. That's what the news was. Really, it was just political news. You know, you weren't catching sports and shit like that. It's like it is now. It's just politics, politics, politics all the time. They call it news, but they avoid, you know, 99% of the actual news of the world. They just focus in on what's going on in Washington. And back then, there was a lot of orientation also. Now, not just Washington, but also like Israel, Palestine. Somewhere along the way that, I don't know, I don't watch TV. Maybe I'm wrong. It seems to me that that has kind of waned off in these past like 3-4 years. But I'm not sure. I'm not present with that. You know, what's different is now you got alternative media, you've got the internet. So a guy like me, I could really just kind of explore out there and find a couple of people who are talking things that I basically relate with, I think, whose opinions and perspective on things make sense to me. And I could just kind of focus in on that. And a lot of these people are not like big famous names. They're not famous people. They're just ordinary Joes, you know. No different, a workaday Joe like me who's just kind of doing his little side hustle or his hobby or whatever. And that involves bringing information forth that is relative to politics. Now, it's like I can engage in politics at a very... in a very light fashion, very quick hits. Like I could just break out my smartphone and I could just go here to this social media site, app, whatever you want to call it, and just do a quick scroll through and a rundown and get the idea of what's going on in the day and walk right away from it and right back into my reality. I don't need my head to be full of this shit. I don't have to be like making a whole study about it, right? And as far as using it as some kind of entertainment factor, I could pick and choose, you know? I could pick and choose whether I want to put on somebody's podcast. And that's another different thing, too. I don't have to listen to what the TV or the radio is laying out there. I could find people, ordinary Joes, perhaps, that are just doing their own thing. And I find them more likable and more honest, you know? Some of them are trying to make a buck at it. I take it with a grain of salt, you know. The more dollars involved, the more grains of salt I take it with. A lot of people are just doing it out of basic passion. It's not necessarily about the money, right? Like I work a full-time job, and then I do what I do in terms of podcasting as a hobby on the side, just out of some semblance of passion. It's not the great passion of my existence. It's just a passion that I'm going through currently, and we'll see how it goes, right? But at this point, I'm not about making money over it. I'm not about replacing my job. I'm about working my job all the way until like 70 years old, where I'll retire. And then we'll see how healthy I am and if I'm still engaged with any of this shit at that point, you know? So you got an alternative media as opposed to the what we know as the mainstream media, right? There's an alternative to that cable news network 24/7 thing, you know. And once upon a time, it was just CNN, and then all these other ones sprung up through the years, and they've locked in and become part of like the heritage of the United States in the past like 20, 25 years with the MSNBC, right? And the well, I said CNN, you got the Fox News. These are the main cable news outlets that run 24/7 and oriented towards politics. And they're all fucking propaganda, right? They're all fucking propaganda. And that's the difficulty with them, right? You're being spoon-fed talking points for a political party, more or less. Now, the way things stand right now, as far as that's concerned, you've got a Democrat Party, which is pretty much operating as a whole, right? They get their marching orders and talking points for a day, and the entire party, every Democrat, is on board with it. Doesn't matter what you think about it personally, you're just on board. They stick together like a school of fish, right? Where on the other hand, in the Republican Party, you've got a massive divide that's going on. And it's between, you could call them a bunch of different things. You could regard them as Bush Republicans, right? You could regard them as neocon Republicans. You could regard them as rhinos, Republican in name only. That's kind of the current jive. But they all represent the same thing. And what they are is your globalist Republicans, right? This is the great divide in the nation here. This is actually what's going on. It's not really so much left versus right as it is nationalist versus globalist. So it seems like almost all the Democrats are globalist. And then you've got some old Bush-type Republicans that are also globalist, but then you've got this whole, what they call the MAGA wing, all the Trump Republicans, you know, that are nationalist. So divide is not on party lines. It's crossed the aisle, and the fight for power is about globalism and nationalism, right? It's not a left and right thing anymore. But anyway, that's something I don't want to get into. Perhaps it is something I do want to get into, but not here in this format. Post-Arlen Monologics is really going to be more personal, and it's about the idea of the runaway train of thought. It's about bringing up subject matter and then running topics that segue into another and into another, and you start at one point, you end up somewhere completely else, right? That's what I've been doing from the beginning, and I've been contemplating a lot. I'm in chapter 46, episode 46, and I'm thinking I'm doing what I'm doing now, what I've been doing all the way up until I end the 50th chapter, at which time I'm going to try and maybe, I'm going to think about it. I got a couple weeks to think about it now, being only at 46. Streamlining it, altering it, making it a little bit more interesting. I know it can be very difficult to listen to one voice going on and on without interruption for an hour to 60 to 90 minutes. It may be that I want to break it up a little bit. I don't know. I haven't sorted it. I'm working on that. But I think there's going to be subtle little changes to make it a little bit more listenable, right? Listenable for the average person going forward. Where I want to get into getting into some really deep detail about particular subject matter, topics of conversation, I'm looking at going in a completely different direction. That's not going to be a part of Post-Arlen Monologics. It's going to be some other kind of monologue thing that I'm going to do differently, and I'm going to release in different directions. And it's going to be oriented to a more like-minded crowd instead of the world in general, like Post-Arlen Monologics currently is and how I intend it to be, right? So anyway, those kind of changes are coming on down the line, right? They're coming on down the line. And that would put me, when I start to get into some detail about some of the topics of conversation that intrigue me, that'll start to cast me, as unpopular as I may be, as a part of the alternative media, right? It's that easy. Anybody, you can do it, I can do it. You just get a podcast going and you become part of this alternative movement, right? Alternative is, it's an outlaw movement away from the media establishment that we're getting through TV and radio for all these years, which becomes a bunch of party propaganda. Now, the thing is, a lot of people who are orienting themselves towards the alternate media are finding no satisfaction with the mainstream media. The mainstream media, the CNN, is geared towards leftists, Democrats. MSN is oriented towards leftist Democrats. Fox is oriented towards the Rhino Republicans, the Bush Republicans. And none of these mainstream outlets are orientated towards the MAGA Patriot movement within the Republican Party amongst the conservatives, which actually, you know, by population, massively outnumbers what's the representation in Washington, D.C. In other words, there's more representation of rhinos in Washington than there is as a population in general across the country. The conservatives the conservative people in this country are far and widely MAGA patriots. That ain't even close. You're talking in the 80 to 90% is my reckoning. And the rest of them are probably bought and paid for by what remains of the rhino powers, right? In other words, they're getting a paycheck. They will be talking heads on Fox, for example, that were part of that old co-opted Republican thing. And that's what it was. We call them rhinos because they're not Republicans. They're not conservatives generally. They pretend to be. They consider themselves to be. They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. They're sold out to globalism, which is anti-American by definition. There's no way you can actually be a full-on conservative. Now, you might have a conservative lifestyle, maybe. Maybe not. We don't know what these famous people do in the shadows when they're done with their day's work, making $1 million a day to read a fucking teleprompter or whatever. But anyway, getting away from all that, right? There's an alternative media now, and the people that are oriented towards the alternative media don't really find any solace in the mainstream. And most of those are going to be the MAGA patriots as it is. And I talked about, like, you know, whether you are in the mainstream media or oriented to it, and whether you are in the alternative media or oriented to it, you're going to run into these same conditions here where politics are concerned, whether you're left, right, whether you're globalist, whether you're nationalist. And what it is people are making money off of this shit, right? And big money and easy money. If you could be an influencer, if you can get enough followers, you know, you can make a lot of money for a little bit of work. It's all about, it's a popularity contest is what it boils down to. But once you get the popularity, you also have to make an effort to keep people engaged. And you can have some high times when it comes to politics. There could be a lot of shit happening, you know, the news cycle of the day. You can have a dozen different very important points to address that get people fired up. And then you can have doldrums also, where there's not really a whole lot of going on. Like, the machine is turning and everything is kind of smooth. There's nothing dramatic. And you got to kind of keep up, you got to come up with ways to keep people connected and interested in what you're doing. And this is where that fear porn comes into it, right? This is what happens when we start to occupy our thoughts with these politics and the debates, really things of the world. Like I said, I made the distinction between the world and the church before, right? The church is a general term for Christianity. We get away from our Christian faith. And hey, many of us have no Christian faith at all. So you don't really have much of an option. You're in the world, right? And but you still have your base of faith, whatever that may be, and your own actual reality, your own actuality to attend to. but we find diversions from it. We get away from whatever our spiritual base may be. Live in this diversion, live in the debate, live in the argument. And we're looking for the next morsel of something that actually compels us to stay engaged. What do I mean by that? Two words. Fear porn, right? And I've mentioned it before. Fear porn. Fear porn is a way to get addicted to information outlets. We live in terror. Whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right, both camps in this debate in our culture, both ends of the polarity that we are currently addled by, suffer fears of what's to come. The left is terrified that the MAGA patriots are going to come back into power and they're going to turn this into a Christian nation, and they're going to shove all the homosexuals back in the closets, and they're going to light up all the fucking witches and antichrists at stakes like the Calvinists did up in Massachusetts, right? In Salem, the colony up there, right? The Democrats are living in terror of that possibility. And on the other hand, you've got the conservative people living in the same kind of terror, but on the other end of it, that the Christian persecution is going to come, that they're going to come to the doors to take your guns away, and they're going to put you in that situation, whether you get to shoot it out or surrender your freedom. Either way, as a nationalist patriot or as a Christian, you're facing persecution and death. So there's that fear. So we need to know what's going on so we can stay on top of things and move and plan accordingly, right? The more afraid that we are, the more engaged we remain. The more engaged we remain, the further we are off the center of our actuality and whatever our base of faith may be, we're further away from the core of our spirituality, right? So fear porn as a generator of income for so many of these media people, whether it's mainstream or whether it's alternative. We as listeners have got to gauge ourselves on a daily basis. You know, like I said earlier, the advantage of the modern era, the technology that's unfolded in the past 30 years, beginning with the internet, the personal computer, the internet, the improvement of the networks, the hardware, the software, into the development of smartphones, these handheld computers that do so many things with so much power, we have the ability to accomplish the end of getting quickly to what's going on in the world, in the realm of politics, without engrossing ourselves in it. We don't have to sit in front of a TV, the boob tube, right? To be hypnotized, watch 60 to 90 minutes of MSNBC or CNN or Fox or whatever, right? To try to get the story while, you know, the TV has that hypnotic effect on you as you watch it. And what they're speaking about is 99% opinions and propaganda and 1% actual occurrences of events throughout the course of the day, right? You're getting op-eds and you're getting talking points, marching orders, propaganda, party propaganda from these news outlets. Whereas, you know, when you just listen to an audio podcast, like I'm presenting here, audio podcast, it's a voice. And when you've heard enough of it, you just cut it off, you know? But better than that is the people who do these things, who are in the alternate media, they also have social media accounts, and you can just go look at it, and a lot of the things that they've got to say, as far as the news is concerned, like you go to Twitter, right? You've got limited characters. If you want to parrot or forward some news that you've gleaned throughout your career or hobby in the alternative media, you just post it up there right quick, and then somebody like me or you could just scroll through it. You know, we pick and choose who we follow, and we scroll through the information as it lays out, and you could look at it every like 4, 5, 6 hours and be totally up to speed with what's going on without fully engaging in it. You could take 1 minute of your life, get caught up, and walk right back into your normalcy and live your life. Nonetheless, I still check my level of engagement as a red flag. And I question how much, how grateful I am for the life that God has laid at my feet. And if I observe that I am starting to engross myself in the political debate, I realize that I have become somewhat of a brat, somewhat disgusted with God's portion for me, which is obviously a sign that I have become spiritually off kilter, and I've got to drop everything and make that right quick. At my age and with my experience, I know how to right that ship quickly, right? 30 years ago is a different story, a way different story. But it's another story, and I don't want to get into that now, right? See, the thing is, we're just ultimately just pawns in this game. The game is power. And the people who are involved with it are power fucking addicts. I promise you, almost exclusively across the board. And if they didn't show up to Washington, D.C. addicted to power, when they got there, the culture absorbed them into it. It's like when you go into a casino, right? Like, I'm not a gambler. My father had a gambling issue. I don't. I don't like it. I don't like the environment, you know? A game of chance, all right, a little here. If I have $100 to throw away, I'll throw it and see what happens. Maybe I could double it and walk the fuck out. That's my attitude to it. When you go into a casino and you hang around in there, you could just feel the immorality. There is something about gambling, you know, gambling is, it falls into classification, morally speaking, within the categories of the Ten Commandments as they're laid out, is greed. Right? That's what it is. It's greed. It's an aspect of greed. You're putting yourself in an immoral situation in a casino in the realm of greed, not much different than you walk into a bar that has prostitutes or a massage parlor, a whorehouse in general. Now, it's sexual immorality, but you still got that same feel. You can feel it like stick into your skin. Something's wrong. And you walk out of it with a weird feeling. It's hard for me to describe exactly, but I don't like being present in a casino, right? We got the casino. I talk about 78 goes up to Denison. Well, you go up to Denison, and then you just go a little north into Oklahoma, and we've got Choctaw Indian Nation Casino right there. Very local. It's a 90-minute ride, maybe. Probably not even an hour, 15 minutes to get to. And I've been to it a couple of times. And as I'm speaking to you, this is what I got in my mind. But I've been to Atlantic City and I've been to Las Vegas. The feeling is always the same. We've got some kind of degenerate lifestyle going on. You walk into it and you come out wearing it somehow. I feel the same way about being overly engaged in the political debate. That's what I'm getting to. You understand that? I'm overly engaged in a political debate. I get that same sense of immorality. Why? Because my spiritual center has shifted. Why? Because I have found myself dissatisfied with the wonders that God has portioned for me. And make no mistake, I have been granted unbelievable abundance. They may be bottom shelf items, but I've got all kinds of them, and there's all kinds of happiness at the core. I've got a great marriage, a great wife, a whole lot of love. I scratched and clawed my whole life and only found trouble and drama and problems and following God's lead and doing things God's way, I have stumbled into the greatest situation. But human that I am, I can find dissatisfaction with it. I've always got to check. My reality is actually a very good one. There's challenges, of course, but we need those challenges. Challenges create character. It's adversity, overcoming. I've spoken about these things before. It grows us. It matures us. And this world needs maturity. It needs a lot of maturity right now. We're just pawns in the game, you know, is what I was getting to. We're ordinary people living ordinary lives, and we get off kilter when we start to idolize these things, the people and things, like the talking heads and the voices on the AM radio and whatever, wherever we're getting the information from. We start to have idolatry occurring, that we're definitely getting spiritually off kilter, and we're giving it up for what? Right? We're giving up the sense of goodness in our abundance and in our beings in exchange for what? Grandiose ideas that somehow we impact the world from our little fucking perch in the corner of nowhere? We're pawns in their fucking game of power, right? The power game, the power people. It's all about them. It's all about their glory. It's all about their money. It's all about whatever the fuck these federales are doing in Washington, D.C., which is a really fucked up cult of people. It's a really horrible society, and I'm almost 100% certain about that. It may not be 100% fucked up, but it's damn close, and the ones who are not sold out to it, they're getting worked on, you know? It's fucked up. Washington is fucked up. Anyway, I'm just an ordinary guy, and so are you. We're workaday Joes, like I say, and we're really, what, worth a vote? And the vote don't even seem to matter. Fuckers have been cheating the system since Adam and Eve. I got my book, which I brought up before, my James A. Missioner book about Texas, right? Big old fat volume. I remember, I haven't read it in a while. I read it once or twice years ago. But a chunk of it involved the election fraud that was going on here, local, county, state levels in Texas, 120 years ago. All right, this is not a new thing. This has always been going on. It's been brought to technological levels that are almost supernatural by this point. But make no mistake about it, that's what it takes to come to power. Power people want power, and they don't care what it takes to get it. They will lie, cheat, and steal, and kill for it. The idea that there's no election fraud going on, 2020, 2022, 2018, the attempts at it at 2016, it's always been going on. That's a reality. Anybody who thinks differently is just lying to themselves and everybody else around them. My ultimate goal in life is to live for my faith and then die for my faith. These politics, this bickering back and forth, this left versus right, you know, the left-right paradigm. It's not really that significant in the grand scheme of things. There's reason why Christians orient themselves with things of tradition, particularly where America is concerned, right? The left-right paradigm as far as America is concerned. Christianity and conservatism line up because there's a moral basis in the tradition and foundation of this country, right? The legal system, the laws, have a basis in Christian morality. Not to say that this was ever a Christian country by design. It really was not. It was classically liberal. It was the idea of independence and individuality in a pursuit of one's happiness, right? To use the word that the founding fathers used. It's not I don't think, a Christian nation by design, but its basic criminal law and other laws related have a foundation in Christian morality. That being the case, the traditional nature of this country is morally Christian. So a Christian will tend towards that tradition, and that is conservatism, right? I mean, there's a reason that it is so. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think the health of a nation requires the duality represented in left and right. Right? You're talking about conservative, as I'm speaking to now, countered with progressive ideology. All you have is the gas pedal and the brake pedal. It's the function of go and stop, of go but slow down. And both of these forces work together for the greater good of the country. There's a necessity for it. Unfortunately, we're not really living out the left-right paradigm anymore. The left-right paradigm is specific to the health and wealth of the United States of America. That is a nationalist left-right paradigm. Like I said earlier, we're not talking about that split, that division. We're talking about nationalist versus globalist. It's a completely different political spectrum, a different paradigm. That's where things are fucked up. So the globalism is anti-American, while nationalism is pro-American, and each has its own left-right paradigm. So we are in a very fucked up period here. We are undergoing a new un-American revolution from a left that is at once Marxist and full of all the marginal attitude those that hate tradition. They don't like to look back on the history of the United States, for they never seem to see the good in it all, only the bad. They recognize only where their quote-unquote kind or quote-unquote their kind have incurred some semblance of oppression. So they are marginalized. They feel un-American, so they pursue an un-American future. We are not on the same page anymore, as far as our left-right paradigm is concerned. The left-right paradigm, where it concerns globalism, is your Democrats, who are leftists, versus your quote-unquote conservative rhinos. Right? Those are globalists with a conservative orientation, but their conservatism is not necessarily in relation to, say, the founding documents, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, the things that that really set the tone for what this nation would be. No, their conservatism is more of a lifestyle choice. They choose, for example, not to be homosexual. They choose, for example, not to be drug addicts. These are people that actually like to work for a living, right? Those are traditionally conservative values, right? Family values. They prefer to have a wife and children and raise a family up and be educated and become productive workers, right? But that does not necessarily harken back to Christianity. That does not necessarily harken back to the Bill of Rights. It can, in some cases, for some people. But their real interest being globalization is not to hold fast to the founding of this nation, but somehow bring some conservative value to the progressive institution of globalism. It's weird. It almost doesn't make sense, but it's part of a whole separate left-right paradigm that is globalist at its root. Nationalist, the nationalist left-right paradigm doesn't have much in the way of a left. You're talking about Kennedy type of Democrats. You're talking about Jefferson type of Democrats. They do exist in this country. There are patriotic Democrats that are looking to perfect the United States of America and not obliterate it and replace it with whatever it is the fucking globalists have behind door number two, which from all the white papers I've observed and heard tell of, it's kind of a ugly dystopian type of future. I don't want nothing to do with it, really. I really don't. And this is what I'm saying before. My goal in life is to live and die for my faith, right? I'm not going to die for my patriotic conservative notions. No, that's a wasted life as far as I'm concerned. You know, fight for it, perhaps. But would you come up to me and say, okay, renounce your American patriotism, or we're going to chop your head off, I will just renounce it. Because it's dead anyway at that fucking point, more likely than not. Again, it would be a wasted life. I'm looking ultimately at my place in the afterlife, you know, in the netherworld, in heaven, hopefully, right? My martyrdom for the sake of politics affords me absolutely nothing in that regard. I die for my faith. It means everything. I die for my political philosophy, my governing and economic and cultural philosophy. It's a wasted life. It's a wasted death. It's dishonorable, right? I spoke about fear porn, right? And the insertion of fear into a person's purview, yeah, your thoughts start to focus with some kind of basis in fear. The natural reaction to being afraid is fight or flight. So the more we engage in politics and more stories that we hear, the bigger the boogeyman comes from the other side of the aisle or the other political paradigm, as the case may be, and is, right? I said it before, Democrats and Republicans alike, they have fearful ultimate outcomes where the imagination of their opposition's intent is nightmarish, is a terror to behold. When we hear more and more, we are compelled to fight or flight. And that's something that happens at once. That compulsion, fight or flight, happens all-inclusively, and we decide on how to act in the moment. You've heard of bug-out bags, right? Preppers. When the shit hits the fan, right? S-H-T-F, shit hits the fan. You grab your bug-out bag and you hop into your bug-out vehicle and you go out to your bug-out property and what? Go and hide from it all. Hunker down and hope the angel of death passes over you. That's the flight. The fight, obviously, is when it comes to your door. You know, when the communists are at your door, the Marxists are at your door. These globalists are at your door, the New World Order, when they're at your door and they want your guns. Now you got to fight for your freedom. Fight or flight. that's the natural response that comes with being afraid. But that's not the proper response. It's not the spiritual response. My goal is to live and die for my faith. It's not to live and die for my patriotism. It's not to live and die for my politics. Somebody tells me to renounce my patriotism. Fuck it, I renounce it. Somebody tells me to renounce my faith. Fuck you, I don't renounce it. That is standing the ground. There's no running at that point. There's neither fight nor flight. That is my opportunity to die a martyr. That is my opportunity as a layperson to be sainted. That's a big deal. That's a very big deal. Lay people have a hard time becoming saints. You could read about the lives of saints through Orthodoxy, right? And invariably, well, not always, with rare exception, but invariably you're talking about monastics who live their lives in prayer, who are set apart from the wiles of the world and deal with the sin as it wells up in them, as they're beset with little to no temptation, compared to your layperson who's got one foot in the kingdom and one foot in the world and has to deal with this shit all the time, every sort of temptation, 100 times a minute, and still keep the faith and try to stumble your way down the path of transformation and holiness. Way more difficult. So what I'm saying is these saints, you'll find them to be almost invariably monastics, clergymen, and maybe nobility, right? In the old days when you had nobility, you had aristocracies, theocracies that were built up around Christianity, like Tsarist Russia, for one example, right? The Byzantine Empire. You know, the 1,000 years of Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman, you know, the Greek Christian Empire of Byzantium out of Constantinople. Tripping over my own tongue here. It is not easy for a lay person dealing with the temptation and the aggravation of humanity and all the diversions that are at your disposal, especially in this modern technological era, to be sainted. Martyrdom is your ticket, you know? It's your ticket. That's a special place in the afterlife that comes with that. So we neither fight nor flight when the opportunity to die a martyr comes up, but rather we stand our ground, offer up our necks, die with honor, right? Die with honor. Think of Worf, right? The Klingon character from Star Trek The Next Generation, Worf. His ambition as a Klingon is always to live and die with honor. And I find that character influential. And when I contemplate Worf, though it's science fiction, and it's not necessarily Christian and quite possibly anti-Christian, I know how to dissect it and find value in it that pertains to me. When I contemplate the character Worf, it helps me to get centered into what's really important to me. And that word honor, it can seem a little bit of an umbrella term. It can seem a little ambiguous. What exactly is honorable? But in my life, honor is relative to my spiritual condition. It's the things I do properly within the bounds of God's will and God's way that are honorable. And Worf is a reminder to me about living and dying honorably to my faith. You know, we misunderstand the word meek, and I may have mentioned this to you a time or two in previous episodes, but meekness is not weakness. See, meekness is that discipline. It's a strength in discipline that'll stand up to influences, to being outnumbered, to being unpopular, to standing alone in a crowd. When the general consensus is steering you away from the dictates of your faith. You're in a crowd of atheists, and they're all talking about atheist things, atheist beliefs, atheist philosophies, how they hate God, how they hate Jesus Christ. And you're grossly outnumbered in these conversations. Do we succumb to the temptation, that need we have to fit in? Or do we stand our ground and state our beliefs and remain unchanged without regard to what they have to say, how influential they may be, what it may cost us? Perhaps that situation is something that comes up in the workplace. You just happen to be one Christian amongst the fucking snake den of atheists. And when you stand your ground, do you lose your job? Do you lose your place within the company? Meekness is the strength of discipline to stand by your faith first, foremost, always without fail. That is not weakness, that is strength. That needs to be understood. Most people seem to misunderstand that. So martyrdom, right? Surrendering your head to the sword when you are challenged to renounce your faith, that is an act of strength. And you will find many of the martyrs had to incur that end, or many of the saints had to incur that end and became martyrs as a part of their sainthood. Now, sainthood is also expressed in miracles. God, the Holy Spirit, working through a person to do something supernatural beyond human capability. A miracle like with the touch curing leprosy. A miracle like resurrecting the dead. These are supernatural powers. They are beyond our human capacity. But God will work through the very righteous to accomplish those ends. So whatever happens here, wherever your stand is politically, whatever you fear from your opposition as the ultimate, most terrible, terrifying outcome possible, when it's all said and done, when the smoke evaporates and the dust settles, it is written that the meek shall inherit the earth. And who are the meek, of course? Those who stood for the faith in Jesus Christ. They will all be resurrected bodily, and the afterlife will consist of a new heaven and a new earth, populated by the faithful. The meek shall inherit the earth. Now, that comes obviously from a Rush song, right? 2112, the 2112 album. I think it's the end of what? The overture section of 2112. Side A of that album. Written by the drummer Neil Peart, right? Neil Peart, who passed away in the past 2 years or so. That widely regarded as the greatest rock and roll drummer there ever was, right? The Canadian progressive rock band Rush out of Ontario, right? It was him who came up with these fanciful words, right? The meek shall inherit the... No. No, he took that. He borrowed that from Holy Scripture. I don't expect he was exactly Christian. My inclination, my reckoning, my memory serves me to say that he was more of the atheistic type, but I can't be 100% sure about that. And nobody knows how a man died, you know. In the end, we have that last moment, and it's between you, God, and the devil, you know. What happens then and there kind of really matters, you know. And what happens then and there is really going to be... subject to what had happened all the way leading up to that moment. It's hard to suddenly become Christian in your last 10 breaths when you have been exactly opposite of it all the way too. Hey, if you can do it, it works. The old 11th hour, you know? But it's very difficult to do at that moment in time for a lot of reasons, you know, a lot of different ways. But no, Rush did not pen, Neil Peart did not pen the lyrics, "The meek shall inherit the earth," that was taken literally from Holy Scripture, right? You could look in the Gospels, Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 5. It's a section beginning at verse 3, which is known as the Beatitudes, right? The Beatitudes. You've probably heard this before. I go to church on Sundays. Part of our Orthodox liturgy, every Sunday, goes through, our choir goes through these Beatitudes. And it goes like this: "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn." Now, this is Jesus Christ preaching, right? The Sermon on the Mount is how it's known. "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Right? There that is. "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Right? There's that persecution for righteousness' sake, standing by your faith. "Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall all manner of evil against you, shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." Right? This is the idea of orienting yourself to the afterlife, seeking treasures in heaven rather than on earth, which comes later in the Sermon on the Mount, or at least later in Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew. If it's not in the Sermon on the Mount, it's damn near the end of it. I'm pretty sure it is. Anyway, so all this being said, right, there was a little Holy Scripture for you to contemplate. Hopefully that meant something to you. Maybe that was something you never really heard before. Maybe you had no idea Rush actually took that from the Bible. A lot of rock and roll you'll find come from the Bible. It's usually twisted up and misappropriated, but it comes from Scripture in a lot of cases. A lot of different bands you wouldn't expect. Anyway, the consideration of politics, entering into the debate, being overly engaged in a left-right paradigm, and the way things are right now. I mean, it's the war between globalism and nationalism here in America, and really worldwide too. You've got nations out there that don't want to be part of the globalist agenda. They prefer what they call a multipolar society. It's nationalism. The Chinese want to remain Chinese. They don't want to subject themselves to some one world dictatorship. Russia's the same. Iran's the same. And a lot of other countries around the Arabia, around the Middle East are like that. Countries probably down in Africa are like that. this is not a slam dunk on a global level. The polarity is global. You have nationalism versus globalism all over the world. And we have it right here in America as well. Because of this, and because of the desperate measures that I believe that the globalists have already imposed in these past couple of years, and how fucked up was the presidency, the first 4 years of Donald Trump as president, what the Democrats were doing, and even his own, you know, Rhino Republicans, going up against them, putting proceedings on them. Lawfare is what it's called, right? In the modern vernacular. It's really just tying somebody's hands up with court dates and court cases and trying to create a bad name and control the narrative and put this person away. Get that nationalist the fuck out of there and far away from power while we are trying to impose our globalist agenda and overturn this nation. It was fucked up then, and then when 2020 came around, the year of the election, to get rid of Donald Trump, things got even crazier. 2020 was one of the most peculiar fucking years in the history of mankind on a global level, but very much so here in the United States, perhaps more than anywhere else. The COVID and the emergency powers and the election and the Black Lives Matter and the Antifa and all the Marxism that went with both of those groups. And I referred to what was going on in that year as the insane communist Chinese theater. But I may have been mistaken about the Chinese part of it. It was more of an insane globalist theater, which is socialist slash communist in its economical basis, because that's what the left has become, you know. Economically speaking, it's a piss contest between socialists and communists. Anyway, without going into all the details about that, I believe that 2024, the next presidential election year, is going to be similarly insane to 2020, but brought to a whole new fucking level. And the significance of the outcome is actually much greater in the year to come than in 2020, the year that was. It's obvious to me that these criminal globalist revolutionaries, and that's what they are, they're staging a revolt against the nation of the United States of America. They're fucking desperate. They gone all in. There's so much criminality. There's so much treason. There's so much obstruction of justice. There's so much nefarious international affairs, potentially involving biological weapons, the use of COVID to create a scenario by intent, right? There's sex trafficking. There's child trafficking. There's all kinds of malice and disgusting vulgarities involving both of those things. The war in Ukraine, over Ukraine. There's shit that's gone on in there that is like ground central for nefarious international activities that so many senators and representatives in Washington, D.C. are tied into for profit, for gain. All this shit stands to be brought to light and brought to justice, depending on who the powers are, when the time is right. to pursue these ends. The criminals, the globalist criminals, are all in. They have everything to lose now, and there's no way to turn back. There's no way to say, you know what, fuck this. We're not going to charge so hard. We're not going to continue to steal elections. We're not going to continue to do criminal and immoral things. We're just going to kind of like reel it in, dial it back, focus on making the United States a better place for all the citizens in it, throwing in our two cents of progressive ideology to working towards it. No, they're not going to do that. They're criminals, and they're about to stand tall before the man. And that's going to mean jail time or executions for everybody involved. Nobody is going to throw in the towel. Nobody's going to go down easily. They're fighting to the bloody end. So anything is possible in the next 2 years. The closer you get to that election, the more fucked up shit is going to be. And this is going to be way different. This is not going to be COVID lockdowns. This is going to be some other shit. And I believe that all these illegal aliens that are being flooded into this country over the open borders have something to do with the Democrat plan, the globalist plan, to achieve their nefarious ends. So stay tuned for that. They'll do anything to retain the power. They have no choice. It's life and death to them now. Like I said, they're all in. It's all or nothing. And should they get their way, should they never have to stand tall before the man, they win this election coming up by hook or by crook, whatever it takes, because it doesn't matter. The ends justify the means. There will be persecutions to follow. Their fear of what may happen to them if they lose is going to be turned outward on us, patriots, on us, Christians. I don't doubt this at all. Nobody's going to extend the olive branch. It's all or nothing. These are Marxists. These are globalists. These are socialists and communists, both of which have histories of eradicating large sectors of the population. Genocide. Hitler and the Nazis performed genocide on Jews. They went after all kinds of political opposition and all kinds of cultural undesirables to wipe them completely out of Germany. Those were socialists. The communists over under Soviet Union, as it was at that time, out of Moscow, under the rule of dictator Joseph Stalin, went after the political opposition. Killed millions. Literally tried to starve Ukraine to death. The Holodomor in the early 30s. Genocide. There's no way, with any kind of basic knowledge of history, that we can walk into the year 2024 unaware of what's to follow if these globalist, criminal, treasonous, un-American, anti-American, Marxist scumbags get their way. We're all going to be put to the test of our patriotism and faith. Don't die for your patriotism. Die for your faith. Make it count. Die with honor.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at post-stalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@post-stalin.com.